This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. One part of the credit for President Trump's victory in 2016 goes to Catholic voters who cast their votes for the Republican by a closer margin than is typical. And now former Vice President Joe Biden, a Catholic himself, is working to bring those voters back into the Democratic fold. And did President Trump suffer a loss along with Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin, the apparent loser in Tuesday's election in the Commonwealth? Let's talk about it. On the phone with us is Bloomberg News national political correspondent Gregory Cordy. Welcome, Gregory.
Good to be here with you.
So glad to have you. Many of our listeners will recognize your name from your days as the Cincinnati City Hall reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. And we do appreciate you taking some time now that you're on the national beat. And you've got this piece out today about the Catholic vote, Trump and Biden. And one of the quotes that you include is from George Mason University political scientist who said it's safe to say that Trump at least neutralized what should have been a Democratic advantage with the Catholic vote. What did you find in your reporting as the apparent reason for that?
Well, you know, Trump made a very explicit outreach to Catholic voters, but really it was conservative Catholic voters. Catholic voters are really, they run the gamut from very conservative to very liberal. There's no sort of stereotypical of Catholic voter, which is what makes them a very interesting swing demographic. They usually vote for the winner. There might be a slight Democratic bias over time for Catholic voters, but Trump neutralized that. He hit hard on abortion. He had a list of potential Supreme Court nominees that were thought to be anti-abortion. He talked about religious freedom. He talked about issues that really make conservative Catholics feel like they were embattled during the Obama administration, the contraception mandate in the Affordable Care Act. And so it may not be that he swung the Catholic vote in a more conservative direction, but he certainly mobilized conservative Catholics to show up to the polls.
Well, your reporting also zeroes in on a particular precinct in the city of Dubuque, which you note is apparently referred to as the Rome of America because more than half its population identifies as Catholic. It's got 58,000 people in it. And this one precinct there saw a steep difference in support between President Obama in 2012, whom you just referenced, and he won 73% of the votes at this precinct, while Hillary Clinton only won 58%. So between those Democratic candidates who had very similar positions on a variety of issues, what did you find in your reporting that may have been the cause of that?
Well, one of the things that's really hard to disentangle here is that people have multiple identities, right? I mean, you could be Catholic, but you could also be, blue collar. You could be, or white collar. You could be male or female. You could be white or black or Latino. And so it's really hard to sort of disentangle these things. Catholic voters in Dubuque tend to be whiter than the national average. The Catholic Church is changing. As immigrants come to this country with their Catholic background. But Dubuque tends to be whiter, tends to be blue collar, a little older. And so to the extent that those demographics also went for Trump, that could explain why Catholics went for Trump. The thing about this particular segment of the Catholic vote is that there are these counties in the Midwest that where Catholics are heavily represented, and they tend to be these Obama-Trump voters that we've been talking about since 2016. They voted for Obama twice, but then Trump came along and capitalized on some of the economic insecurity that they were feeling. Many of those people also happen to be Catholic.
How significant of a voting block are we talking about there with Catholics, not just in Iowa, but in the upper Midwest in general, which the Democrats want to win back?
Overall, Catholics are about 22% of the U.S. population. But in states like Ohio and Michigan, Wisconsin, they're in Cincinnati. It's a very sort of German-Irish population historically. And, you know, these are, there are pockets of them throughout the Midwest. And they tend to be in places that are going to be targeted by people of both campaigns. It's, you know, and what we're talking about here are sort of cultural Catholics. They may or may not go to church every week or every day, but they are people who come from, they may have gone to parochial schools growing up. They may live in neighborhoods with people who sort of share this cultural identity of Catholicism. And, yeah, to the extent that they're represented in these swing Midwestern states that we keep talking about, they're going to be an important factor.
And Vice President Joe Biden seems to recognize that they may be an important factor, and so he's working to bring those Catholic voters back into the Democratic side of things. Can you tell us how he's doing that?
Yeah, it's very interesting. If you follow Joe Biden on the campaign trail, he has a stump speech that is not explicitly Catholic. As a matter of fact, he goes out of his way to say, look, I'm not trying to proselytize here. But you'll hear a lot of biblical and sort of Christian themes, a lot of Catholic sort of language, and that he talks about the soul of America. He quotes Kierkegaard saying that faith sees best in the darkness. So he's talking about faith, but it's sort of a generic faith that people of all faiths can relate to. But it's a language that when I talked to one Catholic voter in Dubuque who said, you know, there was something familiar about Joe Biden that I kind of liked, that I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And then I found out he was Catholic, and it just sort of all made sense. There's a sort of resonance that his rhetoric has with Catholic voters that I don't want to call it a dog whistle, but it's something that is sort of a shared vocabulary that really appeals to people who, like him, may have gone to parochial schools or grew up Catholic.
One of the issues that is often of serious consideration for Catholics and evangelicals alike is abortion. And Vice President Biden's position on that issue has evolved over the years from 1982, certainly, where he voted for something that may have been in contrast to Roe v. Wade, to recently saying that he no longer supports the Hyde Amendment in more recent legislation. How is he addressing that particular issue?
Yeah, and this is one of the central tensions, I think, in the entire Democratic field, is that Biden has been in public life for, more than 40 years now, and has taken positions that were, at the time, he was staking out what might have been considered a more pro-choice position. But as the Democratic Party has moved to the left, he's sort of trailed that ideological shift. Most recently this year, he renounced his support for the Hyde Amendment, which was an annual appropriations rider that prohibited federal funding from paying for abortions. The rest of the Democratic field is more liberal than he is on that, and he had to abandon his support for the Hyde Amendment. And he has been somewhat transparent about this shift. He says, look, at the time, I thought it was the right policy, but as I see attacks in places like Ohio, as the state legislature clamps down on more and more abortion restrictions, Biden says that the pendulum needs to move the other way to make sure that women have access to abortion.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking now with Gregory Cordy. He's covering presidential politics as part of Bloomberg News's 2020 campaign team. He's a Bloomberg political reporter. Gregory, a little closer to home here. President Trump's preferred candidate in the Kentucky governor's race, incumbent Republican Matt Bevin, has not conceded the results of Tuesday's election, but he appears to have lost by more than 5,000 votes. And Trump campaigned on behalf of Bevin at this rally in Lexington the night before Election Day. Does Kentucky's election tell us anything about the state of things nationally?
You know, it's really hard to extrapolate one or two elections in an off year to national politics. Certainly, this was a loss for Trump, and it's I don't want to sort of underplay that. Trump, as you said, came to Lexington. He campaigned very vociferously for Matt Bevin to be reelected as governor. But it's really hard to project into next year and tell us what this might mean for 2020. Kentucky is an unusual state in that it is deep red in national elections. But in local and statewide elections, it's still very competitive. And the governor's office has gone back and forth in recent decades between Democrats and Republicans. And if you look at the rest of the lineup of statewide constitutional officers in Kentucky, they all went Republican. So it was really Matt Bevin and Matt Bevin alone who was the big loser on Tuesday night. And so it's really hard to necessarily draw any national implications for that. One data point that is interesting to look at is that turnout was up 40% or more, and I think that's something that does carry over. There's certainly a very highly engaged electorate in our national politics right now, and you can bet that that bodes well for higher turnout next year as well.
As you mentioned, five of the six Republican candidates on the statewide ballot in Kentucky did win, and they won comfortably. So as you were suggesting from your reporting, the governor's race did look like a specific referendum on Matt Bevin, but he tried to nationalize this race. His ads drifted away from Kentucky-specific issues and started to try to resonate with conservative Trump supporters campaigning against impeachment of Trump and against sanctuary cities and against abortion. Have you talked to anyone who has commented about that strategy by Matt Bevin?
Yeah, and basically what the consensus is it just shows the limits to nationalizing local elections. Local elections are becoming more and more nationalized, even down to state legislative races. You'll see a lot of times people trying to cast their opponent as being for Trump or for Nancy Pelosi, trying to really characterize members of a particular political party as embodying all of the positions and the baggage of the more extreme members of that party, no matter what the level of it is. And that can be a very effective strategy, but I think voters also can make up their own minds and see through it, especially in a place as independent-minded as Kentucky.
Well, Virginia also had a big night, a much bigger night for Democrats than Kentucky did. The Democrats gained full control of the state government there, winning both legislative chambers. They already have the governor's mansion, so they're in total control in that commonwealth. In what ways are the results in Virginia more or less telling about 2020 than Kentucky?
Yeah, one of the things, you know, Virginia tends to get a lot of the attention, and I've always suspected it's because it's right across the river from where all the political reporters, national political reporters work. And there were a lot of nationalized issues in Virginia this year. Specifically, gun control was one that might have had particular resonance. We had a mass shooting incident in the Newport News area a few months back. Of course, the Virginia Tech shooting still resonates throughout Virginia. A lot of the ads in the state legislative races were on the issue of guns, and Virginia's changing. In Northern Virginia, you have a very sort of deeper blue sort of section of the state. As people move to the Washington region for federal jobs, they come from all over the country. They're not quite as conservative as Virginia has been historically. And so some of these social issues that you might think of Virginia as sort of a border southern state to being a little bit more culturally conservative, and that's changing. And so that it's an interesting barometer. And certainly if you look at the suburban, then this is true of Kentucky as well. If you look at the northern Kentucky suburbs, if you look at Kenton and Campbell counties went for Andy Beshear, and you saw the similar effect in Virginia with the suburbs going deeper and deeper blue.
We're talking with Gregory Cordy. He's a national political correspondent for Bloomberg News. And you did break down some of these battleground states, indicating that the suburbs are going to be the main place for this battleground. And I'm wondering where else around our neck of the woods you could see that playing out.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at Ohio, it's really interesting looking at a suburb level. If I were to tell you of even 10 years ago that Blue Ash would be a Democratic bastion, I think people would be a little skeptical of that. And yet here we are. You see that throughout Ohio with places like Westerville outside of Columbus, places like Rocky River, just west of Cleveland and Hudson in Summit County. These are all affluent, very highly educated suburbs, and they went Democratic in 2016. And on the other side of the coin, you see places like, Boardman outside of Youngstown, Barberton outside of Akron, Parma outside of Cleveland, that went from Democratic to Republican. These are places kind of like maybe a Cheviot or a Norwood, although those places have not changed. But you do see a real battle for the suburbs, as suburban women especially seem to be in play. But also the key marker here is education. People with 4 years of higher education, we saw in 2016, were more likely to vote for Hillary Clinton, and those without were much more likely to vote for Trump, and that seems to be the key demographic marker of party affiliation these days.
So is that a demographic shift that's taking place in the suburbs, or has that demographic been in the suburbs long and their views on issues are changing?
I think the suburbs. I don't think it's both. The suburbs are changing as you know, people move out from the city each new generation. But as I said, you get, especially with women, you also get sort of an aging out effect. You get remember every 4 years you have maybe 6 or 7% of the population that dies off, and then you have another 6 or 7% that grows up, goes to college, and moves out to the suburbs. And so what we're seeing is long-term demographic shifts that President Trump sort of accelerated with this very specific appeal to blue-collar voters who are concerned about trade, concerned about their jobs. That had a backlash effect to some extent with more highly educated voters whose jobs, say you work at Procter & Gamble and live in Blue Ash, your job might depend on trade. And so you have people like, I shouldn't pick on any one person, but you have John Pepper, the former chairman of Procter & Gamble, a Cincinnatian, who used to be a Rock Ribs Republican and now would tell you that he's a Democrat and supported Hillary Clinton. That kind of business-minded in Cincinnati, that kind of business-minded former Republican might be a little more liberal on social issues and is moving a little bit to the left.
And you broke down at Bloomberg some of the battleground states that Trump won in 2016 and the possible economic woes they're facing. Which states are we talking about, and does it look like their direction in the next election could be changing?
Yeah, I mean, it's seven states, and it's all the places that we talk about, those Midwestern swing states, including Ohio, but also Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. And what the data that we looked at comes from the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank. They look at leading economic indicators to predict which states may be heading into not necessarily a recession, but maybe a contraction. It's certainly slower growth, maybe even negative growth in the coming year. And it's a lot of these states, look, they are being disproportionately affected by President Trump's trade war with China. The agriculture and industrial sectors are particularly sensitive to that. These are states that have been transitioning away from a manufacturing economy for some time to begin with. But what we're seeing really is a divide in the economy, that there are still many places in the United States that are doing very well. If your economy is dependent on technology, certainly, or healthcare, those are growing sectors of the economy. And in other places, in states like Ohio, it's still in transition. And this is going to be a key question for the 2020 presidential race, is do those states, those blue wall states that voted for President Trump 3 years ago, do they give him a second chance to finish the job, or do they decide that these trade wars are not as easy to win as President Trump has said, and decide to go in a different direction?
Bloomberg News national political correspondent Gregory Cordy, we so appreciate your time today. Gregory, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely, anytime.
Governor Bevin is still looking to hold on to his job despite being down by more than 5,000 votes after all the ballots were counted on Tuesday. Democrat Andy Beshear declared victory and is planning his transition and his inaugural ceremony. But in a post at the online magazine Slate, this question was raised in a headline: could Matt Bevin steal the Kentucky governor's election? So joining us now to talk about it is the author of that post at Slate and University of California, Irvine, Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science, and author of the forthcoming book, Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy, Professor Rick Hassan. Rick, thanks so much for taking some time with us.
It's great to be with you.
So the post you wrote at Slate, you're quoting yourself saying, ordinarily, I would consider the possibility preposterous as it relates to a theft of the governor's election. But you said, we do not live in ordinary times, though. So what does that mean exactly?
Well, you know, the fundamental proposition when we talk about a democracy is that the person who gets more votes in a system where whoever gets the most votes wins actually goes on to take office. And what was floated by Governor Bevin and the Kentucky Senate president on the day after the election was the possibility that even though Andy Beshear is about 5,000 votes ahead, that the Kentucky legislature could use a seldom used procedure and resolve a contest between the two candidates for governor and actually hand the governorship to Bevin, even though Beshear has more votes, based on completely unsubstantiated claims of irregularities and voter fraud. Fortunately, today, since I wrote that piece, it looks like a number of Republicans in the state legislature have been rejecting this move, but it's not over yet.
You did write about Kentucky's rules that it has to resolve contested elections and the strange notation that those rules don't apply to the governor's race. So, like, instead, there's a constitutional reference that contested elections for governor and lieutenant governor are determined in the General Assembly. That has not been needed since 1899 when that law was first drafted. But from your legal perspective, what would that process look like if something like that were to take place?
Well, so, you know, the rules are not really in place. They're not really developed, as far as I understand, in terms of what the General Assembly would do. The details of how that would work are unclear. But I expect that if there were a process and the process led to choosing the election loser over the election winner, you would see Andy Beshear going to federal court and trying to raise federal constitutional questions. And there are really two, equal protection and due process. One is the idea that you'd be treating some voters, those voters who voted for the larger number of voters who voted for one candidate, worse than the voters who voted for the losing candidate. And also, courts have said that you can't have a legislature or another body changing the rules for conducting the election after the election has already happened. I mean, that's a very basic proposition. And so if you start saying that we're going to have a new process and that process is going to lead to the loser being declared the winner, that raises federal constitutional concerns. So it would be a real mess. And hopefully the legislature won't go forward with anything like that unless there actually is evidence that Bevin can come forward with to show that there were large enough irregularities that they could call this 5,000 vote margin into question.
We're talking to law and political science professor at UC Irvine, Richard Hassan. You note in the post that you wrote about the Kentucky situation that there are some places, Wisconsin and North Carolina, where perhaps some unprecedented partisan legislative action have taken place. What did we learn from those two instances?
Well, so in both of those cases, you had a Republican legislature with large majorities facing an incoming Democratic governor. And in both states, the legislature took action to try to strip some powers from the governorship before the Democrat could take over. And both of these power-stripping arrangements led to lawsuits. In North Carolina, some of the things that the legislature tried to do were reversed. In Wisconsin, the issue is still being decided, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court is hearing cases involving this question. But it does seem that we're seeing much more of what political scientists and law legal scholars are calling constitutional hardball, with Republicans being pretty aggressive about using whatever powers they have to try to hold on to power even when there is a shift. And so this possibility in Kentucky would be a dramatic escalation of that, but it wouldn't be wholly unconnected to what we've seen before.
Well, the Republicans do have supermajorities in both chambers of the state legislature in Kentucky, and they will have a Democratic governor coming in. I'm wondering if, from your scholarly perspective, as an instructor of both law and political science, what do you think that these types of issues where one party tries to strip the other of its power. What kind of influence is that having on just rank-and-file voters' perception of the electoral process?
Well, I think that there's a lot of mistrust right now, and just judged on the kinds of comments that I see on Twitter from people when I would post something about these kinds of problems. We're living in a very polarized society where each side doesn't trust the other, and when there are changes in rules that have real effects on political power, I think that undermines people's confidence in the process and makes people think that everything is really up for grabs. One thing I noted this morning is that President Trump, who had been complaining about unsubstantiated claims of voter fraud ever since he became a candidate for office, has not weighed in on Bevin's claims. He's really distanced himself from that, which I think is actually a hopeful sign that maybe there are some limits in terms of how far people are willing to push the rules and the ability to try to affect what Democratic and Republican voters actually express when they go out to vote at in the polling place.
Rick Hassan is a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, and the author of the forthcoming book, Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Professor Hassan, thanks so much for taking some time with us today. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley and Hamilton County Commissioner Todd Portune have reached a deal for further development at the banks, and two popular local TV personalities are saying goodbye. The Friday News Review continues. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Did the Brent Spence Bridge Project play a role at all in the Kentucky governor's outcome? And the city of Cincinnati and Cincinnati Public Schools are approaching a deadline on a new agreement related to tax abatements. The Friday News Review continues now with Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wederick. He's on the phone with us. Chris, thanks for spending some more time with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Michael.
So let's start with the bridge issue. You write about the business community, and you know well that they have been the loudest advocates for a bridge project. But you write in your analysis of the tight governor's race in Kentucky that that project has been on life support for some time. So what role do you see that bridge having played in the outcome of Tuesday's election?
Well, I think, you know, as a lot of people know, there was a debate kind of right before the election. I think it was October 29th, where the bridge the topic came up, and Governor Bevin said, you know what, we're going to have tolls to get this project done. And the governor-elect Beshear said, well, now, wait a minute. I think that Northern Kentucky, they should, you know, they should decide how to pay for that bridge themselves. And so once again, it was kind of deja vu all over again, right? To quote Yogi Berra, you know, in 2015, Bevin campaigned against tolls. He won Northern Kentucky big time. And then, you know, it took 4 years for him to kind of come to the conclusion that there was no way to finance the project without tolls. Business leaders in Northern Kentucky, they're kind of facing kind of the same situation here 4 years later. They've got a governor-elect who's kind of indicated he's really skeptical of doing tolls and wanting to listen to Northern Kentucky residents who don't want them, and so they've got a persuasion project on their hands, I think.
And we should note that there has been some debate about the issues that played the biggest role in delivering Kenton and Campbell counties for Andy Beshear, the Democrat. Those counties went big for Bevin 4 years ago, but he was also dealing with angry teachers who were upset over pension reform legislation. But you do note correctly that this flip in position by Bevin on tolls happened just a week, 7 days before the election, and Andy Beshear did play it coyly. And I think it's also important to note that the previous governor who preceded Bevin also had the last name Beshear and also ultimately worked very hard to try to get the Brent Spence project done by using tolls.
It's the ultimate irony.
It really is. And so you could see Bashir's position sort of solidify in the days after that debate, where he was a little vague on the debate stage. He came out wholeheartedly and openly against tolls by that Friday. So where does the project stand now?
It's been in limbo for really most of the last 4 years. Now, the Bevin administration did a study of it, and the popular alternative is to build this eastern bypass through Ohio and northern Kentucky, but it's the cost of that is in the billions of dollars, as well as the Brent Spence Bridge. So, but the study concluded that the eastern bypass was not alone going to relieve enough traffic to really make the corridor work better than it does today. So, Bevin's been sitting on that study, and I don't think that before the election it was completely unknown that he was moving towards tolling. I think that it was at least known among what you would call maybe the elites in the community, and he had said some things in front of business groups and whatnot to indicate his shifting position on it. So, now it comes to Bashir. He's going to come into office. He's going to appoint his own transportation cabinet, and so they'll have to take a look at that work and see what's what. You know, the business community, as I've talked to them actually today and yesterday, they believe there's a little bit of daylight in Governor-elect Bashir's statement, and that he talked about trying to arrive at consensus. And they hope that maybe they can persuade him, as they eventually were able to persuade Governor Bevin. They also agree that, the teachers were the primary factor in northern Kentucky. They point to election data from Fort Mitchell and Fort Thomas. You know, these are very, very Republican areas of northern Kentucky, but also areas that really care about their schools, and they believe that the governor lost those cities because of the teacher issue.
Yeah, so it was surprising to see a Democrat carry multiple precincts in Fort Thomas, but also in Florence, and in addition to all the urban cities that typically go with it. But you've got some other great stories out this week that we want to talk about, and we couldn't have you on without talking about something going on at the Banks Riverfront Development. And I think last time we had you on, things looked a little scary again about what was going to happen. But Hamilton County Commissioner Todd Portun and Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley have struck a deal on developing the rest of the Banks. What does this mean?
It means that the Banks is kind of like East and West Berlin, right? The county is going to get basic control over 1, 2, 3, 4 lots, basically, at the Banks. The city is going to get control over another 2. They're just north of the stadium, and the county gets control of lots, basically, that are south of GE. And this was a deal that was struck between the mayor and Commissioner Portun. Commissioner Portun's house over the weekend, and they basically kind of came to an understanding. The mayor's concern all along has been that the county's deal with the Bengals to lay off some of the future enhancements that may be needed at Paul Brown Stadium, that deal would prevent some of the Banks' lots from being developed. The county has long disagreed with that analysis, but the way the mayor described it was, while Portun disagreed with the analysis, he also understood the city's concerns, and so he was willing to grant that request that they have control over lots 1 and 13. Just so listeners know, the city owns those lots. They are directly north of the stadium. And the county, the lots that the county will control, they also own those lots. So the process that we've seen at the Banks, where the county and the city would both ratify development, it's kind of that process. We're moving away from that to where the city and the county will independently decide what will go on those lots. And in the county's case, it's already kind of decided that a music venue will go on one of the lots, and a park will go on the lot adjacent to it. And they hope to do a mixed use development with apartments and residential just south of GE. So that's where things lie.
Well, prior to the reporting of this deal being struck between these two men, it seemed that their professional or political relationship had been somewhat strained over this issue. Do we know any colorful or insider details about what might have gone down at Commissioner Portun's house that changed the game here?
Well, the mayor said that they kind of got out the agreement, and it was really just the two of them and maybe a couple of their aides, and they started kind of reading through the agreement, and the mayor said that was a helpful exercise because Commissioner Fortune started to see his side of things, even though he didn't really agree with the city's legal interpretation of what was going on. So, and as you know, Commissioner Fortune is really fighting a tough battle with cancer. And so, you know, he at one point a couple of weeks ago had gone to the county commission meeting and basically kind of read the mayor the riot act. He said, you know, John, you need to stop doing what you're doing at the banks. He interpreted the mayor as still trying to stop the music venue. After that speech, the mayor called him the next day and said, hey, you know, can we meet? Can we get together? And that's kind of how that meeting talked. It's very typical of the mayor to do that type of thing. He does, when people are angry at him, he doesn't hesitate to reach out to them. So it's kind of not a surprise. And they have done a number of deals over the years. They have fought each other. They'll both tell you about it. And so it's not a, not really a surprise that they were able to come to a deal, but it just took you know, them making the step to meet.
In our last minute or so together, Chris, talk about this deadline that the city and the public school district in the city are facing as it relates to tax incentives.
Yeah, our cover story today looks at the Cincinnati Public Schools and the city's agreement on basically abating property values to kind of spur development. They have a December 31st deadline for that agreement to expire. There's a lot of infighting over that issue as well. The city and the school district, a lot. It's kind of similar to the county situation with the city. They don't really agree on the facts at this point. And so there's a lot of work to be done in the next 6 weeks to try to get an agreement on how to extend those tax abatements. Both of them, the city and CPS, they don't have any disagreement about coming up with another agreement, really. The issue is, or that there could need to be an agreement, the issue is how to get there.
Our thanks to Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, whose stories are online at the Business Courier, and we have some links at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab. Chris, thanks again for all your time.
Thank you.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. 10 years after Fort Hood, the forgotten soldier and the father who is still fighting his war is a new long-form story by Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Keith Birigalik, who joins us now on the phone as the Friday News Review continues. Keith, thanks so much for taking some time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is such a wonderful story, and we have such a short amount of time together that I'm kind of glad that's the case, because people shouldn't get the whole story here. They should definitely head over to the Enquirer and read this excellent reporting. Keith, tell us who Joshua Berry was.
Well, so Josh was a soldier in the Army. He was living in Warren County before he killed himself in 2013. He was deployed to Afghanistan for about a year, and when he came back from Afghanistan, he was at Fort Hood, and he was getting ready to come home. And then the Fort Hood shooting happened, where 13 people were killed, dozens more were injured, a really horrific attack. And Josh was there, and he injured his shoulder diving behind a desk during the chaos. Now, he wasn't shot, but he was injured. And then after that, he developed some PTSD from that and from also some other experiences. And just kind of started to go downhill from that, and he really struggled with feeling left behind and feeling like the Army and the U.S. government and society in general didn't really have his back once he got home and once he was kind of struggling with what had happened to him.
Was he suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder?
Correct.
And so where did he feel that the services for him were inefficient?
Well, I think from, you know, the story that I look at is, you know, it's Josh's story, but it's also his father, Howard, and sort of how he came to terms with everything that happened and what he's been doing since to try to raise awareness of post-traumatic stress disorder and just try to get better care for vets. I mean, I know one of the things that Howard really felt was did not go well with his son was just the amount of drugs that he was prescribed and given. And he kind of looked at it as like, okay, we're just going to drug him up so that he's okay. And there in the report, I look at, you know, like the incident report from his death. And it's just a shocking amount of prescription drugs that were prescribed to Josh, that were in his apartment that the police found. I mean, it was dozens of bottles, some of them empty, some of them weren't. So that was definitely one of the things that he and his father struggled with.
Josh hanged himself at the age of 36 in 2013. The headline of your story, again, talks about the father who is still fighting the soldiers' war. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about Howard, Josh's father, Howard Berry. What is he doing?
Well, I met Howard at a cemetery, and it was, you know, he was putting a flag in a grave. I was actually there for another story I was doing, but I see Howard walk up and put a flag in this grave, and I went up to talk to him because I thought he might be related to this person that I was writing about. That's why I was at the cemetery. And Howard said, no, I never met him, but my son is buried a few hundred yards away, and he told me a little bit about what happened to his son. And he said, you know, he feels like his son's been forgotten. His son felt like he was forgotten and left behind. So he doesn't want others to feel like that. So, I mean, Howard has written, you know, more than 500 letters to Congress advocating for benefits to Fort Hood shooting victims. For several years, the survivors and their families weren't getting the benefits that they should have been getting. And Howard also, he goes to different cemeteries every week and plants flags at different graves of veterans who have taken their own lives.
Yeah, you have a lot of photos in here taken by Meg Vogel, the photographer, and you see Howard Berry at Gate of Heaven in Montgomery, at Spring Grove Cemetery, and he visits his son's grave every week, you wrote.
Yeah, he does, along with other graves of veterans who have killed themselves, because Howard, you know, I don't know how much Howard knew about suicide and veteran suicide and PTSD before his son did what he did. And I think that's kind of the case for a lot of people. I mean, I was with Howard when he put up 600 or so flags at Spring Grove Cemetery. And, you know, he's telling me the number one thing that people ask him when he tells them, oh, I'm putting up these flags and here's why. And he tells them, you know, how many veterans are killing themselves every day, every month. I mean, the numbers are sort of impossible to verify, but, 22 a day is a number that's used a lot. And Howard says the first thing people say is that I had no idea. So, yeah.
You wrote that this death caused Howard to feel like he doesn't have a family anymore, and he says he's been told by his wife that he cares more about his quote dead kid than his alive kids. So Howard's really facing some turmoil in his life as well now.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things that he told me is, you know, nobody gives you a playbook for what to do when your son kills himself and when your son's 36 and he does that. So, you know, he's having to deal with that. And one of the things that Josh struggled with before he died, and obviously there are a million different factors usually when suicide is involved. It's not always just one thing that happens. But one of the things that Josh was struggling with was he was a new father. He had his wife had given birth shortly after all the Fort Hood tragedy happened. And so he was really happy to be a father. He showed pictures to his group at the VA where he was getting some services. And then his wife left him because she couldn't handle the PTSD and all the different battles that he was fighting. So Howard doesn't get to see Josh's daughter anymore, and hasn't seen her for years. So, you know, this is someone who I think part of it, you know, part of the reason he goes to the cemetery every week, part of the reason he puts up flags at strangers' graves, part of the reason why he, you know, goes to Columbus and lobbies, is because it's a way for him to deal with his grief, and it's a way for him to have a purpose and to try to make something positive come from something so terrible.
The title of the story is 10 Years After Fort Hood. You can find that at the End of the Inquirer. It's written by reporter Keith Beery-Gulick, who's been our guest on the phone. Keith, thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
And we close out the Friday News Review here in the studio with WVXU media beat writer John Keyswetter. Keys, thanks so much for coming in again.
Hey, it's always a pleasure.
So we've got 3 minutes to get through a few things. Two more very well-known and well-liked Cincinnati TV personalities, journalists, are leaving. I mean, it's a whole generation that seems to be leaving.
It's a generational change, really, when you look at it. You know, it's John Popovich, sports director at Channel 9, been there 40 years. Cammie Durking, co-anchor at Channel 12, been there 31 years. Earlier this year, Jeff Hirsch left Channel 12. Marty Brenneman left in September. So, and then last year, there was Deb Dixon, Joe Webb, Larry Davis, Tom McKee, Ken Brew. So it's all the guys my age are
and you're still ticking.
And I'm still ticking. Having fun.
What is Cammie's reasoning for leaving?
She actually told him in April that she was leaving. And I've not talked to her, but she has said that the changes in the news biz, which would be changes in ownership and how Channel 12 News is operating, which was the same thing Rob had said here on Cincinnati Edition last month. Yeah, she made it I broke the story in July, and she tweeted it out overnight. It's officially official with a copy of my July story, but it wasn't July this summer. It was July 88 when I broke the story that she was going to be the area's first female sports anchor, which was a big deal back in 88.
Yeah, it was even a printed news story that she had to take a picture of. So that was interesting to see. And I also learned from that, or maybe was reminded, that her dad was Connie Durking, who played at the University of Cincinnati in the days of Oscar Robertson.
And the Royals.
And went on to play professionally with the Royals being first drafted to play for Syracuse.
And so, she's quite an athlete. I mean, her bio says that she was a three-time Ironman, I guess Iron Woman, triathlete. And so I don't know what you know. She's still relatively young. She'll do something. I'm looking forward to catching up with her sometime after Thanksgiving, before Christmas, and we'll blog about it.
Well, we'll try to get her in here when she's out of
the
station. Okay, so we've got 35 seconds for you to explain something really cool that's happening in here tomorrow. It's a radio production of an old teleplay.
Right. It's called O'Toole from Moscow, written by Rod Serling. It was a one-hour comedy from 1955, only aired once, live on TV, no tape, no film. And so we've adapted it as a radio drama. And Ann Serling, Rod's daughter, is coming in today from upstate New York. She's going to be our narrator and host. We have 8 very talented students from CCM who are going to be actually doing the roles under the direction of Professor Richard Hess. And we've changed it from a one-hour TV drama to a one-hour radio drama.
And do we have a date yet on when we might get to see this? Because it's being produced, basically recorded and produced over the weekend.
Yeah, but after that, we have to add the music and the sound effects and all that. I believe it's going to air in the first quarter of next year, which would be right in the sweet spot of spring training right before opening day. That's our goal.
It's going to be so exciting. Looking forward to it. I know you worked very hard on it. John Keyswetter, our WVXU Media Beat writer. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. And the technical director is Josh Elstro. Find archives online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.